Great. Thank you, Catherine. Good afternoon, everyone. Like all of my colleagues up here, I'm going to be talking at a pretty fast clip and skipping past some slides, but happy to slow down with questions or remain available after this session. I'm going to describe quickly and at a very high level a set of recommendations in the recently released final report of a multi-stakeholder group called the Research Integrity Roundtable. And I'll be talking not about methodology specifically, but more broadly about spheres of policy application. Again, no disclosures. Each year, roughly 1,000 scientific advisory committees provide advice to the federal government on everything from emerging technologies like nanotechnology and transgenic research to the toxicity of new chemicals or chemical compounds as they enter the marketplace. And the Keystone Center identified or really was made aware of the need for a multilateral dialogue on issues surrounding conflict of interest and bias, whether actual or perceived, on the part of individuals serving on panels or committees of this nature, and also concerns about the credibility and reliability of scientific information used through various kinds of review processes to inform public policy decisions. The concerns that that led to the formation of this dialogue group included questions about the appointments of individuals with undeclared or underdeclared conflicts of interest or perceptions of excessive biases, a growing burden of information disclosure required to serve on such panels, and insufficient balance between public transparency on the one hand and on the other the privacy of individuals involved. Also, the lack of consistency and transparency in how different studies and data sets are weighed and evaluated once these panels are set into motion, and procedural inconsistency across agency boundaries as to how these issues are navigated. And we also heard an interesting trend or conundrum in the context of anticipated legislative reform, particularly as related to toxic substances, that being a potentially increased burden of proof expected to be placed on industry over time regarding the health and safety of the substances they were introducing into the marketplace, but counterbalanced against rising distrust of industry-funded or sponsored research. So the Keystone Center is a nonprofit organization. It's been in existence for about 37 years, convening multi-stakeholder groups of this sort. The roundtable involves scientists and policy experts from a variety of sectors, industry, government, advocacy, to suggest ways to improve the rigor and transparency of the use of science in regulatory decision making, and specifically to address three fundamental questions. First, how should these panels be composed? How should the qualifications of prospective panelists be vetted? Second, how should concerns about conflicts of interest and bias be navigated? And third, which studies should agencies and panels review when examining the science related to a particular policy issue, and how should those studies be weighted? A major recurring theme of the roundtable's recommendations is transparency, simply a call at each step of each endeavor for more information to be released to the government and to the public. I don't have time to enumerate all of the organizations that supplied individuals for this effort, but you can see, again, the span of different sectors and disciplines. Happy to answer questions about who is involved and how they were selected. Two stipulations I'm obligated to make in talking about this process. One is that the government officials who served as liaisons rather than consenting parties. However, they participated very actively in the discussion. They raised invaluable questions and perspectives and helped the other discussion partners to focus deliberation on outcomes that they were interested in, that helped solve their problems, that they could help to implement. And then second, the protocols of the dialogue stipulated that every individual participant was understood to be representing her or his personal views and not necessarily those of an organization of affiliation. So the organizations listed here are for purposes of sort of identifying backgrounds and perspectives, but they were not asked to endorse these recommendations. Let's see, a little more information about the Keystone Center. But the first stream of recommendations from the roundtable, and by the way, there are copies of the report on the back table if this is of interest to you. But the first stream focused on recommendations for improving the credibility and integrity of scientific advisory panels. There are a number of categories of consideration listed there. I'll talk about as many of them as time allows, from establishment through management, really full life cycle of this kind of scientific advisory panel. The roundtable's single clearest theme, and you see this moving from section to section throughout the report, is the importance of increasing the level of transparency so that there's more information available about the members of the scientific advisory committees, more opportunity to comment on committee charges and membership, greater clarity about what constitutes a conflict of interest, how that's distinct from bias, and about when and how and why a waiver is being granted to allow someone with a conflict of interest to serve, and how issues of conflict and bias should be managed. The roundtable focused on advisory committees specifically that address questions of science, rather than sort of non-science-based policy, stating that such panels should generally consist only of members with relevant scientific expertise. The roundtable deliberately did not explicitly define the important terms of conflict of interest and bias for a variety of reasons, but where necessary, relied on existing definitions provided by the national academies. At a very high level, conflict of interest was understood as referring to a financial or other interest conflicting or potentially conflicting with the service of the individual for this given task, because it could potentially significantly impair objectivity or create an unfair competitive advantage for that person or an organization of affiliation, but needs to be differentiated from simply bias, which is largely intellectually motivated, arises from the close association or identification of that individual with a point of view or a particular group. Bias distinct from conflict of interest is not necessarily disqualifying for the purpose of, and shouldn't be necessarily disqualifying for the purpose of committee service. It's often useful and even necessary as long as it doesn't preclude willingness or ability to consider other perspectives or relevant interests. To the contrary, agencies shouldn't shy away from, for example, including scientists who are considered to be outliers on a given question, provided that that person is a respected practitioner in a relevant field and the committee as a whole represents a mainstream perspective. Some roundtable recommendations regarding the establishment of scientific advisory panels. I would say, most importantly, there was a call for agencies to craft publicly available charters available for comment and for consistent maintenance, consistent with best practices provided by GSA. The report includes detail regarding the recommended content of such charters, and I don't have time to go into it. Also some recommendations for identifying and screening panelists, but I'm getting a signal that little time remains, so I'm going to jump ahead to disclosing interest. A prospective panelist's disclosure should include financial and other items with a 3-year look-back period for themselves, for a spouse, dependent children, fiancé, domestic partner, so someone closer to you than, say, an apartment mate, as well as relevant professional activities, regardless of whether financial compensation was involved. A strong call for agencies to do their own research rather than regarding potential committee members rather than relying on self-disclosure. And a call for means by which agencies can obtain information about prospective panelists from one another. Determining conflicts of interest, very importantly, the overriding goal of agencies should be to appoint only panelists who do not have conflict of interest, and each agency's relevant policy should be much more clear, more consistent with that of other agencies, leaving as little doubt as possible about which individuals would be considered to have a conflict for a given purpose or on a given policy question. Waivers, where they're granted, they should be there should be fewer waivers and a much tighter standard for granting waivers. And panelists who are granted waivers shouldn't be allowed to serve in leadership capacities such as panel chair. Several recommendations regarding managing conflicts of interest and balancing bias, managing the ongoing work of panels, and evaluating these questions throughout the life of the panel. I think in the interest of time, I want to make sure I touch on quickly best practices for conducting systematic scientific reviews, understood for these purposes as a structured evaluation of the strength of the overall evidence to determine what the available literature indicates about a given policy question, a tool to assist experts and policymakers in evaluating the strength of evidence that pertains to a decision-making process. So the roundtable has begun to offer best practices to guide these assessments, recognizing that broad principles are possible, even though in each area of regulation there are different questions and problems, there are different conventions, and they function under different statutes. Just strong encouragement for researchers who hope or assume that their findings will influence policymaking in positive ways to become sensitive to, more sensitive than is typically the case, to the needs of end users of science, including policymakers and their science advisors. So the premise of this body of the roundtable's recommendations is following this process will lead to better policy. So the report discusses each of these phases of a systematic review, providing some examples and suggesting best practices, but at a very high level, there's formulating the problem, assessing relevance, determining standards in advance, so delineating and documenting criteria for relevance, identifying the studies that are relevant to a given problem, determining specific criteria for credibility, evaluating the studies that pass the relevance test for credibility, eliminating those that don't pass the credibility threshold, and evaluating the remaining studies against the criteria test. And then also determining in advance how studies will be weighed to reach conclusions and describing those conclusions and the rationale for them. So again, the recurring theme of transparency, transparent standards for relevance and credibility that are clear enough for readers to critique the standards and how they were used. The members talked quite a bit about elements of credibility. And I'm going to skip over those that have to do with scientific credibility, because, both in the interest of time, and I think they're less controversial and a bit more self-evident than elements of non-scientific credibility, like whether funding sources and other competing interests are disclosed, whether the investigator's financial conflicts were disclosed, whether the principal investigator had the freedom to publish, to analyze and interpret results, to have control of the study design, whether the study was reviewed independently, whether through peer review, still the gold standard, or some other process, and whether the study or key test elements was posted in a relevant public registry, which isn't right now an option in epidemiology or other fields like toxicology, but is in some like pharmaceuticals, and then were the data and methods publicly released. One final substantive point I want to make that was, I think, predictably a point of significant interest for the group was the determination that a given study or data set shouldn't be stricken from consideration a priori because of its funding source, whatever that funding source might be. But the funding source is a relevant factor in assessing credibility. That assessment should take place transparently, and the systematic review should include the establishment and documentation of the funder's involvement with any given study and any restrictions placed on the study's release. And with that, time's up. I can, again, direct you to the report in the back. I'm happy to answer questions now or in between the scenes of different sessions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We have time for one question, if somebody has a question. Yes.
The question is, were there specific incidents that incidents that prompted the formulation of this group and really guided the focus. I think more than anything, it was probably the anticipation of a legislative debate that didn't quite happen around the reauthorization of the Toxic Substances Control Act. And I mentioned that more generally at the beginning of my remarks. And I think even though that legislative debate hasn't yet occurred, the anticipation is that tinder is still fairly dry, and there's a debate coming about that will shift the burden of proof from the government to industry regarding the safety and health of various substances before the end of the marketplace. So the applicability of these recommendations are broader than the chemical industry, but I think that certainly was a motivation for the dialogue.